Hello and welcome to You Should See the Other Guy, the podcast in which we watch a romantic comedy or sometimes trilogy of romantic comedies and tell you why the person who picked a love interest chose poorly and should have selected better from the buffet of options provided to them throughout the movies. I am Jennifer.
I am Samantha Mungo Allen.
And I'm Shaz, aka Sadie.
And this week, we are doing a super duper episode covering all three movies of the Bridget Jones trilogy.
The masterpiece.
The BJCU, as I have come to call it.
If you also read that as the blowjob cinematic universe, it would also be entirely apt.
Yeah. And we've divvied up summarizing duties for the three movies. Mine will probably be very short. Not really a lot happens in the third one when you think about it. But I forget who's laying the groundwork of the BJCU.
Kind of fairly simple plots in the first and third. The second got a little more involved, but I am going to summarize the first. Sadie Shaz will cover the second, and then Samantha will bring that baby on
round
home with the last movie. All right, let me take a drink of water before diving into this. Okay, the year is 2001. Bridget Jones is a 32-year-old woman who works in London and is kind of a mess, you know, as are many people. This is was an interesting look at a period in time, I will say. You know what? In fact, I'm going to begin this summary by reading to you all a comment that I sent to my brother after watching, which is, quote, "I watched Bridget Jones's Diary, 2001, for the podcast today, and all of the intended lulls about weight and women's hygienic maintenance standards are Starship Troopers level satire awful, but just what it was like for real then, because this movie kind of plays it all straight." So anyway, Bridget goes to a party at her parents' house for New Year's. It's like a curry party, and everybody is really concerned about her being single and unmarried at the hideously old and dried up age of 32. Her mom attempts to address this or by somehow putting her in like an outfit that one of my elementary school teachers would have worn in 1992. She meets Mark Darcy, who is Colin Firth, and they hit it off. Not at all. Bridget is very awkward and smokes a lot and says some stuff that doesn't sit well with him. And then she overhears him insulting her to his own mother. And that kind of lights a fire under her ass. Well, first, to think that this guy is a real asshole. And second, that this is going to be her year. She's going to get her shit together and get a man and her life is going to be on the come up or whatever. And all of this is presented through her own voice, her thoughts that she puts in her diary, which very unfortunately in the first movie heavily also brings up, she is always listing tiny fluctuations in her weight and counting the amounts of units of alcohol that she drinks in given periods of time and thinking that she is disgusting and fat when she is a very thin person played by a very thin actress who very famously, I recall, People magazine reporting breathlessly on how much weight she gained to play the role at the time. And that is all very unfortunate and does not age well. Anyway, Bridget works at a publishing company for a guy named Daniel Cleaver, who is played by Hugh Grant. He begins to Hugh Mungo begins to sexually harass her on the job, but she receives this positively and calls it flirting and responds in kind because he looks like Hugh Mungo Grant. So they have like a book launch where things go awkwardly, and she has another run-in with Mark Darcy, who she thinks is an asshole, and this woman who's like his law partner, who she thinks is his girlfriend, but is not. And after she kind of makes a total ass of herself in front of a giant room full of people, Hugh Mungo Grant swoops in and takes her out to dinner, tells her a big sob story about how Mark Darcy slept with his fiance and ruined his relationship, and which Bridget Jones responds sympathetically to this. They go back to Hugh Mungo Grant's place, and in spite of her gigantic underwear, they have sex. And the sex is awesome, and they are into each other, like boning all the time, even though the ethics of this are really fucked up because he's her boss. And now they're a couple or whatever. So they go on a holiday weekend that's going to coincide with a family party that Bridget has to go to, that like her creepy uncle, who's not really her uncle, who's always grabbing her ass, like has set it up to be a Tarts and Vickers party. This seems like a really strange theme for a family party, but Bridget is game. She brings her
the
new boyfriend.
Iconicness they happen of to run the Tarts in. And Vickers party. Is unmatched.
They run into Mark Darcy and his law partner, who wants to be his girlfriend, but they are not officially together out there. And Mark is looking at her longingly from across the little shallow lake while she and Hugh Mungo Grant have fun and are silly and splash around. And Mark Darcy is, you know, buttoned up and stayed and talking about the law. And so then Hugh Mungo and Bridget have more sex, and she tells him that she loves him and wants him to tell her that he loves her back, but he completely dodges the question and then predictably comes up with some bullshit reason about work, why he can't stay and go to the family Tarts and Vickers party with her anymore and has to leave immediately and go back to London. And she takes him at his word about this and goes on to show up to the Tarts and Vickers party dressed as a Playboy bunny. However, the Tarts and Vickers aspect of the party has been called off and she was not notified. So she's just there like looking like a hoe with a bunch of old family members. Has a nice conversation with her dad. There's a whole side plot going on about her mom has like left her dad for like a whatever the British equivalent of a QVC presenter is, who is named Julian and has a very orange spray tan. Okay, then Bridget goes back from the awkward party to go meet up with Hugh Mungo. Hugh Mungo is all charming and tries to like scooch her out of his apartment quickly. And then bump, 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 turns out his big work emergency was boning some American lady that he also works with, because this guy really likes to fuck where he works. And Bridget is upset and leaves and is going to call off the relationship. She also quits the job working for him in a rather satisfying scene. Her new job is also terrible. She goes to work for the horrible British media in a position where she's supposed to be like on-air talent and is like a journalist or whatever, but they really just kind of like use her as like comedic, sexy relief or whatever. And do 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 do. Oh, and then our first big incidence of racism pops up in these movies when somehow she manages to get an interview with a guy who's going to be extradited to his home country, who's going to execute him for his activism. Because Mark Darcy is kind of low-key secretly in love with her and manages to set that up, giving Bridget a career boost and also making her like Mark Darcy. And I guess also good for the guy who is not going to be murdered by the fascistic regime in his home country. Let's see. At what point does he tell... Did that already happen? Anyway, at some point, Mark Darcy tells Bridget that he likes her just the way she is, which is kind of a nice end.
That's when he comes over to help her make her birthday
was
dinner
it? See,
post-breakup.
I felt or like no. it, that happened before.
Oh, no, it was at some snooty gathering.
She was at the smug married's dinner, and everybody's like, oh, yes, you're a big loser because you're 32 years old and not married. And then he like follows her downstairs and tells her that he actually really likes her a lot, and he likes her just the way she is. So this kind of
and
has these thoughts percolating in her
brain. And she
accidentally
puts on his big coat.
Oh, okay. I remember that happening in the second movie. I see now. It was a running theme. Anyway, so this kind of like, this series of events like prejudices her more in favor of Mark Darcy. Then he turns up and helps her fix like the disaster birthday dinner she attempts to cook for herself, and he's getting along with her friends and everything is great until Hugh Mungo Grant, having been dumped by American Laura, turns back up with flowers and is going to like try to talk his way back into her life. life. And these people are absolutely insane because none of them just kicked him directly out of the apartment to start with. Like, I just don't understand this like British repressed communication style. It was very weird to parse. Anyway, things blow up. And the best part of the entire movie happens. Mark Darcy and Hugh Mungo Grant take it outside and have a fight, which is like the greatest fight scene of all time because it's just two non-athletic, like British white men sort of flailing at each other. And like,
don't they make a fight happen in every movie too?
Yeah.
It's like a hallmark of the series. Yeah.
And they were all pretty great, but the first one was the best because I wasn't expecting it. And hearing Hugh Mungo Grant yell, "I'm going to shin you," while he's hopping around trying to kick Colin Firth in the shin was just really funny. They like crash through a restaurant, fuck everything up. And then Bridget gets mad and is all like, "You're no better than him," to Mark Darcy, because she still thinks that he was the one who slept with Hugh Mungo's fiance, when obviously the rest of us have sussed at this point that Hugh Mungo is a charming, perpetual liar about everything. And the situation is the other way around. Let's see. Bridget's parents get back together, and from her mother, Pamela, Bridget learns that, as we all had suspected, the cheating situation was the other way around, and it was Hugh Mungo Grant who seduced Colin Firth's wife away from him and broke his heart, even though they were like best friends and he was the best man at the wedding. So then Bridget's like, "Oh, I really fucked it up." So she runs off to like all these functions, these family functions going on. This is bizarre to me. Anyway, she goes to like Mark Darcy's parents' Ruby wedding anniversary
all the time.
Like, it's a lot of functions, like formal functions, lots of family around. And anyway,
are you coming to our Fortnite second Biscuits Eve party? You know?
Yeah. They keep a little notebook and they mark in there whether you turned up or not. So anyway, then Bridget gets led to believe that Mark is going to propose to this other lawyer chick, Natasha, who he's not actually interested in. And she like yells about it in front of everybody, but then she's like, "Oh fuck, I'm making a fool of myself." So she leaves. So then, and he's going to move to New York. That was the thing, right? So that was going to like mess things up. I think she like she comes clean about her feelings to Mark Darcy, and he's like, oh, bother, or something that British people say, because like, you know. So anyway, she's bummed out because he's gone off to New York and her friends arrive and they're going to take her on a trip and have fun and stuff. But then Mark Darcy, Colin Firth shows back up and he's all like, "Guess what? Fuck New York. I want to fuck you instead." And so they're all like, "Woo." And then they stop kissing because the friends are like yelling at him from the taxi. And then they go back inside. And then Bridget is like, "Oh no, I'm wearing my ugly underwear. I have to go change into some like tiger striped underwear instead for some reason." And she leaves him standing out in the room with her diary, which she like specifically tells him to read what is lying on the table, which seemed like a strange choice. He picks up the diary and reads all the stuff from like the last year where she hated him and said he was awful and talked a bunch of shit about him. And then he leaves. And so she comes back out in the underwear and a camisole. And she's like, "Where did you go?" And then she's like, "Oh fuck, he's seen the diary." And so she like puts on some sneakers and runs out into the snow after him in her underwear. And she catches up with him and she's all like, "Oh, I didn't mean that. I mean, I did mean it, but now I think differently. And it was just a silly diary anyway." And then he's all like, pulls one of those rom-com perfect man moments and is all like, "Oh, that's why I bought you a new diary that you can start fresh in." And she's all like, "Oh." And then they like start making out like in the snow while she's in her underwear. And she's all like, "Good boys don't kiss like that." And he's like, "Oh yes, they fucking do." And then they make out. And that is the end of Bridget Jones's
so
diary.
You sound so swarthy in your imitation. He sounds more like the guy from North and South. Like the miniseries.
Well, or unlike like a pirate. Renee Zellweger.
"I bought you a new diary."
I am not an expert at British accents, but Babe? Colin Firth did drop you? His voice like a few octaves when he made that statement.
"I bought you a new diary. Your old one was full of insults."
Exactly. And that is how it went down. That's Bridget Jones's Diary, 2001.
So, basically,
continue the saga.
Basically, if you somehow haven't seen Bridget Jones' Diary, but you have seen Pride and Prejudice, it's exactly the same plot. So, Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason, aka Bridget Jones 2, came out in 2004. And was kind of panned by film critics, but I love it anyway. So the basic plot of it is now that Bridget and Mark are together, they are kind of a little bit awful and insecure in relationships together. Like they love each other, but they're just, it's just really rocky. Like Bridget is just has a hard time trusting Mark, and it maybe is starting to realize that they're a little bit too different. So I'm just going to gloss over this plot because it is kind of complex, but at the end of the day, it fully doesn't matter because they end up together at the end anyway, spoiler alert. But, there are just several things that happen that make her really insecure and kind of, you know, it starts really nice and like they're having a lot of sex. They're having a total vibe. Bridget is now like a really successful TV reporter, TV person. I really don't. British media really confuses me because I know that there was that period in time, especially in Britain, where they were just like, they had people walking out on the streets and they would just be like, look at this fat person. 70% of Britons are fat like this person. And then that was like the whole TV broadcast. And that was just like, they were just like David Attenborough, but like people walking around London.
Yeah. Like British media, like, damn, Andrew, we have not addressed you directly on this podcast in a while, but my God, how do you all survive this? Like, what a horror show. But Bridget is making a real go of it now. She's a success in the second movie.
Yeah. Every time she shows her ass on television, everyone's like, you're getting promoted. which I
like, literally I love shows her
that
ass.
Happened to me. Yeah. Oh yeah. Fully like ass in the camera. So she's having a vibe, but there are several things that make her really insecure about being with Mark, because firstly, he has a really hot new business partner, like associate at the law firm. And her name, oh my God, I'm trying to remember her name. Rebecca Gillies.
What was her? Oh, that's
it. Anonymous lesbian.
Yeah. Anonymous. Hey, you spoiled it. It's not a spoiler. It came out in 2004. But she thinks that Rebecca Gillies is obsessed with Mark and that Mark is going to leave her for Rebecca because Rebecca is so much more in line with Mark's circle of friends, with his lifestyle, with his personality. And so like there's a dinner party that they go to where everyone is participating at this like trivia night and everyone is nailing it except for her. Like she has no idea what any of the questions are. And she has a brief moment where she's good at the pop culture section, but then she loses it. And so after that, she's just really sensitive. And Mark is like walking her home and he's like, what's up? And she's just like, you piece of shit. You don't care about me. You left me for dead during trivia night and you're in love with Rebecca Gillies. Fuck you. This happens in like the first 15 minutes of the movie. And so she goes home and then the next day she calls him and she's just like, not even the next day. Like when she gets home, she was like, okay, that was a little bit crazy of me, but also you deserved it. But also please don't break up with me. But he was already like coming over to her house to kind of make up with her, etc. And, he later invites her on a ski trip that is supposed to just be the both of them. And she,
oh God.
So she thinks that he's going to propose to her also. That's another plot point, which is quite frankly bonkers because they have been dating for like 2 months maybe at this point. I understand that she's like on death's doorstep at 32, but like just give it a few more months. But anyway, he invites her on what she thinks is going to be just the two of them on the ski trip. But then once she gets there, she realizes two things, which is that her lies of being a great skier have finally caught up with her. And two, Mark kind of allowed some of his other business partners, including Rebecca Gillies, to tag along as well. And so she's a little pissed, has a madness mayhem moment on the slopes, and then realizes that there's a chance that she's pregnant. And so she goes and gets a pregnancy test. Mark sees her taking it in the hotel room, and he's really excited. And so she's like, oh, thank God, you're really excited. That's nice. And so they're kind of, they start really excited while they wait for the 5 minutes for the pregnancy test to develop. But then it quickly devolves into them realizing that they have entirely different ideas of how to parent and like what that would look like. Like he wants to send him the baby off to Eton and have a very structured lifestyle. And Renee Zellweger or Bridget is just like, I want them to live in the woods. Like she's a very like hippy dippy about it. And so by the time the pregnancy test develops and they discover that she's not pregnant, the damage has been a capital D done. And so she's just kind of realizing that maybe they aren't the best fit for each other. So they go back to London and kind of distance each other. I can't remember if they officially break up at this point, but enter Daniel Cleaver, aka Hugh Mungo Grant, once again. He has started his own like diners, dive-ins, and drives and ditches type show where he like travels around the world and just like tours the culture. And so it's like he really is a jack of all trades because he was a publisher and now he's like a TV host. But his show what is it called? It's like Babes on the Move or something.
It's called The Smooth Guide.
The Smooth Guide. Yeah. Fuck yeah. That's so cool. Anyway,
Hugh Mungo bringing you The Smooth Guide.
The TV producers pitched to her that Daniel Cleaver needs a compatriot, a companion, for his upcoming trip to Thailand, and they want her to go. And she is at first like, absolutely not. But then Daniel shows up in his very like kind of naggy, scathing, but charming, foppish manner and convinces her to come. So she comes along with Shazza, aka my namesake on this podcast recording session. And they go to Thailand. They have a very fun time, but this becomes important later. Shazza meets up with and later shacks up with this kind of younger guy who looks a little bit like Justin Timberlake in the NSYNC era, just a little bit, but not really, like a lot uglier. And Shazza's just having a good time. And it is during this period in Thailand where Bridget gets high on mushrooms and then is saved by Daniel Cleaver. And then later they start to make out. And at this point, she's broken up with Mark, or she's taking a break with Mark. But she starts making out with Daniel Cleaver. He kind of starts to turn her against Mark. He's very conniving and a little weaselly in that way. Just kind of like making jokes at Mark that kind of encourage her to join in along, which she does at first. But they start making out and then she starts to just, but then the door knocks and she opens it and it is a prostitute that he had booked on a routine schedule for the entirety that he was going to be there. And so she realizes like, oh my God, I can't believe I was going to actually go through with this. I am an insane person. I can't believe that I was going to do this. So that's how things end between them. And so as she's packing up her bags, Shazza is like, oh, I can't remember what the guy's name is. I'll just call him Phil.
Jed.
She's like, Jed?
Yeah. Same as the guy who won Hannah B. Jed. Season of The Bachelor and then turned out to have a girlfriend named Haley back home, who then since subsequently went and got engaged to Hannah B.'s brother, IRL.
Well, didn't ask about The Bachelor, Jed. But oh well.
That kind of name.
I kid. Jed, she's like, Jed got me this really cool snake bowl, but I can't fit it into my bag. Will you take it, Bridget? And Bridget, being a nice friend, she's like, yeah, sure, throw it in. So top 10 bowls that were actually filled with cocaine. So the dogs sniff her out. They detain her at the airport, and she is thrown in prison in Thailand. And things get really dicey because they basically tell her, like, unless we can actually find this Jed guy that you're talking about, you're kind of looking at life in prison. Sorry, LOL. And so she's like, oh, sick. Cool. And she has some very interesting and memorable, I will say problematic. It was 2004, racism, etc. But there are quite a few kind of heartfelt moments in this little section of the movie, where she just kind of like gets to know the other female inmates at the prison. They sing some songs together. It's kind of a vibe. But then Mark shows up at some point because he's a human rights lawyer. And he's basically like, they found the guy. I had nothing to do with it, but I was just in the area and I decided to swing by and like let you know and whatever. And he insinuates that he knows that she slept with Daniel Cleaver and that, you know, that's fine, but he doesn't really mean that it's fine. And so she starts to correct him and be like, no, but he's like, I don't care about your personal life, which goops and gags me every time. How dare he?
I mean, she did dump him, and he is a very literal person.
Yeah.
Well, communication style misfires.
There are, for some reason, this particular flavor of miscommunication in this movie, it enthralls me. When I was watching this particular movie for the podcast, I started it at like 11:30 to midnight. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to like watch the first 10 minutes just while I'm like getting ready for bed. And then I'll watch the rest of it tomorrow. Fully accidentally stayed awake the whole time. And I finished it that night at like 1 a.m. I was me who has seen this fucking movie like more times than I have like freckles on my body. And I was just like, oh my God, the tension, it's palpable. I wonder what happens next. So he goes back to Britain, and then a few days, weeks later, she is eventually freed and she is allowed to come back home. And I will say something. Shazza did not even meet her ass at the airport. And I'll say, if I was Shazza, if I was the person who got my friend landed in prison in another country, first of all, I would burn the world to the ground. Second of all, I would be there at the airport ready to slit my throat at their feet.
that's life debt stuff. Like,
yeah,
you need to spend the rest of your existence like serving her and attempting to right all of her wrongs on her behalf after that.
I'm paying for Bridget's rent for the rest of our lives. But anyway, she gets home and Mark isn't there. Then she goes back home to her apartment. Her friends are there. Shazza is there. Apology is not what I would call up to snuff, but they make up. And then she kind of bitches about Mark a little bit, where she's just like, he's a top human rights lawyer and he couldn't even bother to like get me out. So I would probably be home faster if he'd actually bothered to help. And her friends are like, you're such a bitch. He's done everything possible to help you. He like did, and then they list like 50,000 like extremely difficult things. Like he stayed up for like 72 hours straight, flew to like 20 different countries, contacted the British embassy, et cetera, to get her out of prison. Right. So that happened. Meanwhile, the fight scene that had to happen, it is between Mark and Daniel, of course. And it's where Mark confronts Hugh Mungo Grant. And he's like, did you see her getting detained? And what did you do to stop it? And Daniel Cleaver was just like, well, whatever. Like, she wouldn't even fuck me or something. And then Mark is like, well, it's time for me to kill you now. And so he attacks him viciously for like 10 minutes. It's very fun. And then again, Daniel Cleaver.
There's a fountain involved this time instead of a restaurant.
A fountain. The fountain is so good where he's like, what are you going to do? Drown me? And then Mark is like, excellent idea. And then proceeds to try to drown him. But then that is when Daniel admits, like, no, she has gone frigid thanks to you. She didn't want to fuck me. And Mark realizes that she has not had sexual intercourse with Daniel Cleaver while they were on a breakup. She did not pull a Ross. And so switching back over to Bridget. Bridget realizes that she loves Mark and that Mark still loves her. So she runs to his house and Rebecca Gillies opens the door and she's like, oh, Bridget Jones is like, oh God, I have misread the situation. I know that you're in love with Mark, whatever, whatever. And then Rebecca Gillies is like, absolutely not. I am a raging lesbian and I am in love with you. And then she kisses Bridget. And Bridget is like, you know, at this time, I'm more into men, but if I ever change my mind, you'll be the first on my call list. And Rebecca is like, fantastic, great. So she goes to Mark's office in the pouring rain. She's drenched in sewer water. She comes in, breaks into his very important meeting, confesses her love, and then happily ever after. And that's it.
Yeah. Like, girl is always fucking up his work stuff, but he loves
it. She's always covered in some type of liquid. She's always underdressed. And I love that about her.
Happily ever after, you said, Sadie? Not so fast, because Bridget Jones' baby finds
them
split up.
We also need to note the time jump here. So first movie is 2001, second movie is 2004. I was like, what is going on? What era is this? When I started watching the third, and baby, it's 2016.
2016, baby. Renee Zellweger's return to the screen after like 7 years or something of not acting.
Yeah.
Damn. Bridget Jones is 43. Daniel Cleaver died in a fireball in a plane crash. And Mr. Darcy is married to a woman named Camilla who looks sophisticated in high society. Bridget has gone up in the world to work in producing. She has a friend who is the on-camera talent, and she whispers in her ear during interviews. So Bridget is single. At what point do we find out why she and Darcy broke up?
They don't even really make it clear in the third movie. They just introduce him with another wife now after introducing her as celebrating her 43rd birthday alone. And then she talks about, like, maybe that's why Mark Darcy and I could never make it. And they did a little montage of, like, sometimes he has to work because he is a high-powered international human rights lawyer. And this is distressing to Bridget because she regularly, like, just fucks things up at her own job and is somehow still employed there. Which, like, honestly, no shade on that count, because, like, I hate working and probably wouldn't do it if I didn't have to, you know, to pay for things to survive. But come on,
Chicky. I love working and I would do it even if I didn't have to.
And if you were lucky,
I have a sickness,
to have a partner who loves to work in this economy, you need to cling to that person and love them and cherish them and make their home life as wonderful as possible. That is my thoughts on the matter.
And look the other way. I think that even Bridget if they Jones commit atrocities against
treated
you.
Mark Darcy very poorly.
Anyway, Bridget is single and at the urging of her friend goes to a music festival with said Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, I think it was like the Glastonbury Festival because,
yeah,
which I didn't think that that was a thing that people who are not like teens and very early 20s years old went to. But
I mean, I don't think it is necessarily.
She has a drunken one-night stand with McDreamy from Grey's Anatomy. That's right. Patrick Dempsey is in this movie. They wrote Hugh Grant out via the aforementioned plane crash. And now Patrick Dempsey, a.k.a. Jack Quant, has picked up his end of the love triangle.
Her
that's
and
spelled
Jack,
Q-W-A-N-T.
Jack Quant, who fuck
I'm
in
not
a
sure
yurt.
That's a last name. Yeah. They have a one-night stand in a yurt. Then a little while later, Bridget goes to a friend's baby's christening where she sees Mark and he's like, oh, I'm actually getting a divorce from Camilla. Their sparks fly. They spend the night together too, a week apart. Interesting. We're setting things up for surprise pregnancy, Mamma Mia situation. Who is the daddy? Bridget wants to keep the baby. She realizes either Jack Quant or Mr. Darcy could be the father. She realizes that Jack Quant from television is a billionaire who has designed a dating website with some algorithm. I hate that they make him also like a brilliant mathematician, because like that's not how like the Silicon Valley stuff works. They like find a mathematician and pay them like a $50,000 stipend and then like make $20 billion off their dating website. It's not like, anyway. So a bit of fiction here.
Saddled
but what
with the last
expect?
Name Quant. He had to make it count.
Yeah, he had to be a mathematician. Mr. and Mrs. Quant would have been very disappointed in him.
Quant Tom?
So they have like Mamma Mia. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying quantum. That's all I wanted to add. That's my limit of math and physics.
Quantum of Dempsey. Yeah.
They ask Jack to take a quantum leap across the pond to appear on their news show so that they can covertly try to like snip his hair and get like DNA samples to like test and find out who the baby is. But Bridget doesn't want to do a DNA test anyway because she sees the amniocentesis needle and is like, yikes, let's not do that. So anyway, like it comes to a head when they all meet each other at a work event and Bridget confesses to both of them, you both could very well be the father of this baby. They're both insanely supportive of her, but tensions boil between, you know, like green juice drinking Bay Area Jack Quant and old fashioned, you know, let's drink petrol and tea, like, for the baby's health, Mark Darcy. Let's drink whale grease.
Before and, we send him to boarding school, we need to fatten him up with some petrol and whale grease.
So, you know, the romantic love triangle continues to play out for a little bit, too. There's some misunderstanding about his wife and whether there's still feelings there. But Bridget finally, like, confesses her love and they clear up the misunderstanding and they're about to finally smooch when, boom, it's labor time, baby. So, Mark, showing that he no longer values work over Bridget, throws his cell phone out the window. But that means that they can't call 911 or, you know, whatever.
See,
the Brits have.
This is why
724.
You can't harp on the work partner for being a worker. Like, you've got to let them keep their phone and be practical. Like, damn, y'all.
But so Mark starts carrying her. Then, like, Patrick Dempsey shows up, starts carrying her. They go to the hospital. She gives birth. They do the DNA test. In the epilogue, we learn it's okay because Mark was the father after all. The nuclear family order has been preserved. No need for any weird co-parenting situation. Oh, thank God. And Jack is still there at the wedding, and he's just, like, handsome and supportive to, like, I'm able to go along with the light fantasy elements of these movies, but Jack's, like, glib, glassy-eyed, like, I'm totally cool with all of this, like, stuff kind of sends
That's
me a little
a
bit.
Patrick Dempsey signature, though.
And in the little stinger, you find out Hugh Mungo Grant is still alive to appear in the Bridget Jones sequel that we'll get in like 2047 when all of these people are like half androids.
My God. So that is Bridget Jones up to this point.
Sadie, I'm most curious to hear where you land on Bridget Jones. You suggested it. These are iconic rom-coms, beloved rom-coms. Do you like them?
I do love them. I am the father. Sometimes when I'm lying awake at night, I think about my complex relationship to the Bridget Jones franchise, as we all do. And I was obsessed with these movies, with the first two, when I was younger. And I have read the books. I read the first one multiple times. I'm staring at my copy on my shelf as we speak. And it's interesting because in so many ways, it is dated, and like there are many problematic elements that in any other movie I would not revisit because of that. Like the focuses on her weight and like just like other little like problematic things that are just kind of like, this isn't great. But for some reason, I feel like Bridget Jones has just been in my life for so long that it's like, yes, she is buying into a lot of these societal things. Like you're really old at 32 and you're fat if you are above like 120 pounds and all of these other things. But she's like, she feels real. Like she's inviting you in to kind of like be with her. And so it's less of like, I am being taught that this is normal. And it's more of like, this character understands how I feel, for better or for worse, you know? And I feel like as much as it's nice to have a lot of characters who are like our ideal versions of ourselves and of like society, like someone who is plus size and absolutely doesn't care about it and is like vibing and everything, like those characters we need many more of. But also there's something very cathartic about having a character like Bridget Jones, who is really messy, is like steps, like inserts her mouth into her foot, or inserts her foot into her mouth like 10 times per movie and is extremely cringy in so many ways, but also like she ends up with really hot people. And like, this is not to say that Renee Zellweger and Bridget Jones are not like super hot, but they're like, she's like a normal looking person. And like, her personality is a lot. And like, she's messy.
She's coded like plain in these movies, even though like your eyes may tell you differently. Like, yeah, I see what you're saying, Sadie. I agree.
Like you connect with her and it's like, yeah, like I've also said something extremely embarrassing that I wanted to curl up and die, because watching Bridget speak at this party right now, I want to curl up and die watching her. And so I love it. And I love, for some reason, the second one just is like catnip to me, because I love how bad Mark and Bridget are at relationships. And I think that this is one of the Pride and Prejudice adaptations that actually nails like Mr. Darcy so well. Bridget Jones is not entirely an accurate foil for Lizzie Bennet in the slightest, but I feel like Mr. Darcy is Mr. Darcy. like Mark Darcy is Mr. Darcy. partly that's because Colin Firth played like 20 hours worth of Mr. Darcy in the Pride and Prejudice BBC adaptation. So he's had practice, but I think that these movies are so clever and they have such great soundtracks and the characters are so fun. And I love that very specific kind of like early 2000s friend group that Bridget has with Shazzer and like the other people in the group. It's just so fun. I don't know. I love it. I have different thoughts about Bridget Jones' baby, but we'll get there.
Yeah, no, Bridget Jones' Baby is an unholy abomination. More like Rosemary's Baby, am I right? No, I do like I do like them. I like her as a character. I like how messy she is, relatably so. I like that these movies capture the very specific feeling of getting older, thinking, oh, my life was supposed to be together, and then realizing that you still like don't know fucking anything as an adult, and you're still you're just like cosplaying your way through like grown-up life, which is not a feeling I'm not sure ever fully goes away, and or like, at least it hasn't at 35,
especially before you could just like YouTube some cooking tutorials. That was rough when she was like trying to make a dinner just by reading some directions in a cookbook.
Yeah But to that end, and I sort of don't like the Darcy character because he is presented as just like perfect in every way. He is, well, you know, he's a little stubborn and like overly literal, but like he's a human rights lawyer and he's like impossibly like romantic and that kind of thing. And I sort of really like Hugh Mungo Grant's Daniel Cleaver because he feels messy in a way that Bridget Jones feels messy, and in a way that feels truer to life than Mr. Darcy. So when I think it's in the second movie and he says something like, we deserve each other, or like, you know, we belong together or something, I think it's presented as like, oh no, like you need to like run away, like you get away from this snake. But it's like, no, people aren't snakes. We're all just messy little turtles in the mud of life, and these two messy turtles belong together. But that's skipping ahead to my other guy. I want to hear Jen's more general BJCU reacts.
General?
Well, probably general. My Jen's general react, which will probably not surprise either of you, is that I fucking hated these movies. Like, it-
Oh my god!
Oh, it was kind of torture. But I will say that I think that a big part of why I just can't cope, and Sadie, I have some complimentary things to say. I have right next to me my list of good and my list of bad that I wrote out to make sure I didn't forget it. But so doing my little Wikipedia research after watching, after watching, the only one I had ever seen previously was the first one. And I saw it contemporaneously when it came out, and it didn't click with me then, so I didn't expect it to click with me now. And there are some aspects of the second movie that worked better for me, and there are some aspects that really did not. But I think that overall, the big problem with these movies for me is that when I've never read the books, but when I looked up and found that, so apparently the book started as a newspaper column and they did not run Helen Fielding's byline. So it was just like Bridget Jones's diary. And it was supposed to be a satire. Like, I don't know that either of you two were into the glory days in like 2010 to 2013 or so of the blog, the Hairpin, and then the Toast that followed it, and the Hey Ladies series that was on there, that was like a series of emails between the ladies who were always trying to plan functions with one another and argue over who paid what at brunch and who was going to do this and that and the bridesmaid stuff. So apparently the original Bridget Jones's column was explicitly a satire, you know, about these kind of likable, unlikable stereotypes of modern, at the time, you know, avatar of womanhood and this person who was living life. And that makes so much sense. Like, I, after rewatching the first movie, I was like, felt like this is a satire, but it's not, because the movie plays it as such a straight romantic comedy. And I think that's why there's like a weird disconnect to me, that if it had leaned into that more, or I realized that it was supposed to be kind of lampooning this stuff, that I could have enjoyed it more. But instead, where like these movies have great soundtracks, and when you've got the good music and the sort of like stereotypically, like, you know, the rom-com Pride and Prejudice story arc happening in the first one, but then it's just adorned with these creepy little asides about her weight fluctuations and stuff, it just, that packaging doesn't work for me on the whole. And I've, so, but it makes much more sense now, because apparently both the first and the second movie were based directly off of the columns and books that Helen Fielding wrote. And if you're looking at it through that, like that this is a satire angle from the start, of course Bridget Jones isn't going to get her happy ending at the, you know, she gets her happy ending, but then she fucks it up afterwards, you know, after the first movie. And like they're the first, whatever, the series of events that's encapsulated in the first movie. And of course she's going to be single again after she and Mark Darcy get together, because that's sort of the continuation of this stereotype that they're writing about and how she copes with things and stuff. So there's this, sort of this weird merging of that with this characterization that we're supposed to view as more of a whole person and root for, that is a tricky marriage to make there that I don't think completely works. And I think that a lot of the reason that it doesn't work is because of the racism and the dated elements about it. I will say that what truly does work immensely about these movies is Renee Zellweger. I know that there was a lot of brouhaha about her casting at the time, because this is like a British folk hero, you know, character, and she's American, but she is just so fucking charming and likable in this kind of like bumbling, but you know, when she falls over, she rolls over and lands on her ass type of character, that is really charming. And she really makes a lot of that work. Hugh Mungo Grant is incredibly charming. So there's just a lot of chemistry there, and that with the soundtracks and that hysterical fight scene really did work for me. Also, I've got to give it some, on the whole, the entire Bridget Jones universe, some points for not following that. Okay, I was expecting, not having seen the second and third movies, for it to follow the plot arc of, you know, what happens to the first movie. She ends up choosing between Daniel Cleaver and Mark Darcy. She ends up with Mark Darcy. I thought that there would maybe be a bump in the road in the second movie, and then she and Darcy end up together, and then they are married and have a baby, and then that's going to be their challenge. And it really went outside the box, perhaps to its detriment in the third movie.
But, yeah.
But it was different. But yeah.
It went into quantum space in the third movie. Jen, if you had to be trapped on an island for the rest of your life with only the Bridget Jones trilogy, ooh, or the Kissing Booth trilogy, oh, which would you choose?
I would take Bridget Jones, because I would watch simply the Renee Zellweger and Hugh Grant scenes, and just fast forward and ignore the rest. If I were trapped with the Kissing Booth scene, that could be really dire. Like, I might just have to walk into the sea.
I feel like what you have said, Jen, is extremely enlightening. And I think also, like, you are so right that it does feel very satirical. I think that that's part of the reason why I like it, because I think I grew up really voraciously consuming content like this that is just like bumbling kind of mid-size characters who write in their diaries a lot and get with like really hot characters, but they're like extremely kind of brash and like not what you'd expect a quote unquote like feminine heroine to be, which I think is what I was drawn to. So like, and these are predominantly like British series, but like the Bridget Jones series, the Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging series. There's that book, My Mad Fat Diary, The Earth, My Butt, and Other Big Round Things. Like all of those types of like come in threes title series. We're just like,
were all of those real? Yes, or did you make some of them up?
They are all real. The Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging was my Bible. There were like 20 books in the series and they were all so good. Like there was one that was set. There was one that was like, uh-oh, my boyfriend is a sex god. And I loved that. And it was all about, I think her name was Georgia. Oh, no. I can't remember what the name of the character was. But Georgina, something like that. And I loved her. I also, that movie, that book was made into a movie as well. And it's also very good and is formative in my childhood. This and that and Bridget Jones. But I agree with you. Like it's so outlandish, but I love it. And I agree that Renee Zellweger is the only person that could have made Bridget Jones as lovable as she is and like made her not feel super grating.
Yeah, she really, that was some fucking magic. I've got to give Renee Zellweger her props there. And frankly, that again, I think that a little bit of my bias too, going into even seeing the first movie back in 2001 when it came out, was that it was so awful. Like by then I was into my reading People magazine and In Touch Weekly, you know, and kind of in tune with that, with American tabloid celebrity coverage. And the amount of focus on her weight gain for the role and then the focus. And it does where if you watch the movie with no experience of that, it would be a little bit, it comes across better that that's supposed to be more satirical because she's thin. Like in the first movie, particularly, she's not even approaching mid-size. She just wears clothes that are a little too small for her, you know? And they occasionally have other characters make a snarky comment about her weight, but more often it's just herself and like her parents and her, it's kind of, I think that was supposed to be maybe in the original material, just like a fucked up thing, you know, that it's supposed to be like ridiculous. But then that combined with the obsessive, like, oh, Renee Zellweger's dedication to her art, she gained 20 pounds, you know, was like, that kind of put me off from the start. But she looks amazing. Her acting is amazing. She's so fun. The best parts of the movie to me, besides that amazing fight scene, are when she's just on her own, like singing to music with her wine glass in her room, you know? She's just very charming. And so then because I like her then it bums me out when they stick her in these, you know, kind of rom-com situations just designed to humiliate her. And bring her low because, like, why? She's not that much of an idiot. Are you really telling me, movie, that, like, she lied about being able to ski and then is falling off the ski lift in front of all these, like, high-powered lawyers that her boyfriend weirdly didn't tell her were going to be present on the trip? Like, you know, I don't know.
Now that is something that
somebody
would
else, please
to
say
me.
Something that makes sense. That's Sagittarius energy.
I'm thinking, yeah, that's the whole thing. Bridget Jones is just a Sagittarius because I'm thinking about when in my old job, I literally would have like elaborate long conversations with all of my coworkers about like what happened on Game of Thrones. And I never watched an episode. Like I was in so deep and I was so good at like deflecting the question, but I wanted to be included, but then it got in so deep and then everyone was just like, oh, Sadie, like she loves Game of Thrones. Like, that was my whole thing. And it literally felt like,
and then
it
you
felt
couldn't
like
tell
I
them.
Was.
Oh no.
I didn't. It felt like I was starring in my own comedy of errors. And so I think maybe that's another reason why I like Bridget Jones is because she is relatable to my lived experience. And also, like, if we think about, because me growing up as a plus size lady, gal, I had no representation. And so it was like a twofold situation where like there were no actual plus size women on TV representing me. And so me and like, I know that other plus size girls my age felt the same way because I've talked with like my friends before about this, that like, like, we just adopted women who, like, weren't even necessarily even mid-size, but gave off plus-size girl energy. And so, like, Bridget Jones was definitely one of those people. Jennifer Goodwin was another.
She has the round face shape. Oh, so does Jennifer. Yeah, like,
yeah.
Thin women with round faces used to be the only, air quotes, plus-size representation. Like,
yeah,
that was it. Like, damn.
Or, like,
fuck, damn, Sadie.
I don't know if you remember that it was a book and then it was later made into a movie. It was called The Duff, The Designated Ugly Fat Friend. And the person
Wasn't that Mae Whitman?
It was Mae Whitman.
Yeah.
Oh God.
It was like,
Mae
Whitman
got so she was like the her character, and she's a fucking babe. What the hell? Yeah.
She was the designated ugly fat friend. But we were so brainwashed back then that I was just like, oh my God, she's just like me. It's like, no, bitch, people like you don't exist in Hollywood, where they want to, but they aren't getting jobs. Like, it was just like, even like people like Drew Barrymore, also round face. That was the closest that we got to representation.
You got some cheeks.
Yeah.
That's the only fat cheeks, they allow on screen.
Then.
And now everyone is just doing fillers, trying to have the round face again.
Yeah.
With Sadie, is it only been recently that, like, rom-coms have even started veering away from, like, overt fat phobia? Have they even?
They kind of just skirt the issue, I think. Like, if we think about it now, excluding the very rare phenomena of, like, isn't it romantic or... what's the other one? The Amy Schumer, anything that Amy Schumer's been in, who I don't claim Amy Schumer or Rebel Wilson. They're not. There really isn't anything. Like, they don't make fat phobic jokes anymore, but they just pretend that fat people don't exist. And it has kind of been like the rom-com genre has been taken over. Yeah. It's just been kind of taken over by
Thanos snapped fat people out of existence.
Yeah. It's just been kind of taken over by like the uber thin indie girls like Zoe Kazan, who's a very talented actress, but like she's been in a lot of rom-coms and it's like she's just kind of taken over, or like Alison Brie or Maya Erskine, or I'm just trying to think of like people who have like been in a lot of, you know, like, and so we're branching out. And
you still get Sadie, what's the name of the hottie who is always Michelle Buteau? She always gets to be the assistant to the lead, but not the lead herself still. And then
she's become kind of a Judy Greer figure in latter day rom-coms a bit, I think, of like always the friend or the helper, the aide, never like a lead in her own movie.
Did I ever tell you both about the Christmas rom-com that Hannah and I thought up for Michelle Buteau, where she...
You told us you were writing it, but please give us a give us a rundown. I want to hear the summary.
Hannah and I are taking a break on our screenwriting aspirations. We had an idea of Michelle Buteau is like, you know, she stayed in her hometown and she owns like a Christmas tree farm, and then her childhood friend, played by Diego Luna, comes back into town. He is now a single father and they reconnect, and there's more to it. But Michelle Buteau and Diego Luna, Christmas Tree Farm.
I need it to manifest into reality.
But I think about it and it's like, why isn't Michelle Buteau is fantastic. Every time she is on screen in these rom-coms as the best friend, whenever she's on screen, it's like, wow, why aren't you the lead? Like, why aren't you the lead?
Yeah.
And that's not to say that...
Because then who would play Michelle Buteau's assistant if they couldn't have Michelle Buteau to play her assistant? Sadie, you clearly haven't thought this through.
You're so right. I'm so sorry.
No, they could just green screen her as her own assistant. That would
well, they better give her double the paycheck for it.
It is frustrating how long, like, people, especially people of color, like, have to play those bit parts, those samey bit roles, like, over and over and over and over again before finally, like an indie director will be like, hey, seems like you can maybe act. Like, let's try you out in a lead role. And then they have to do that, and that indie film then just becomes like an audition role for them to get like a 10-minute part in a movie that isn't like one dimensional. A tough road to walk, as far as I've seen.
And like,
again, and particularly you go first, Sadie.
Oh no. Well, were you going to say, I was going to say something that was related to fat representation, but was not in any way related to what we were talking about.
Okay. No, because I was jumping off of fat representation to the racism in this franchise. So you go first because yours is more connected, and then we will segue.
Yes. Well, I'll just say, like, even bones of representation that we get, like Kat's character in Euphoria. I don't know if either of you have watched the second season or even the first season, but Kat is
deleted.
Yeah. She's the only
I keep up with Euphoria size. Like you kept up with Game of Thrones mostly. I've watched a little bit, but then I just read the plot lines online.
Jen, I completely understand. Yeah, Kat was the only plus size actress or character in Euphoria, and her character was massacred. Like, truly, she was only in it as like a side character entirely. And what we did see of her, completely different characterization, a complete bitch, really mean, just kind of like unsympathetic. And we only get like 10 minutes total of like one-on-one screen time with Kat. And then otherwise she just plays as like the background character, making like shocked reaction faces to whatever everyone else was doing. And that was really painful to see. And that's a situation where it is fine to maybe sideline a character in a film. But maybe not the only character representing a group of oppressed people. So like, you know, like if you have a cast filled, for example, with people of color, sidelining one of them, it doesn't matter as much. But if you sideline the only character of color, or like the only queer character, or the only plus size character in this case, then it's like, why you gotta do that? Why you gotta do that to her?
That was a really, what's his name? That showrunner, Sam Levinson, right?
Sam Levinson.
Yeah, because there were like Levinson. There were a lot of reports about Barbie Ferreira not liking what he wanted, you know, or you know, having a little bit of friction with what he wanted her to do. And then he's just completely, sidelined. So you get your one fat character and your one dark-skinned actor, the guy who played McKay, he just disappeared after the first episode this season. And that is really not a cute look on Sam Levinson. Like, bruh,
I mean, if there's one thing I live in mortal fear of, it is the Euphoria stands of the world. And it's like, part of the frustrating thing is like, the show seems to like inoculate itself from criticism by like cultivating like a legion of fans who will defend it at all costs because they cast so many hot, thin white people on the show that like the second someone online would try to bring up one of these things, everyone is like, I don't know. It just doesn't feel like there is a very healthy discourse around Euphoria right now. It's just like, every week we read headlines of like 17-hour shooting days, no shot lists, background actors alleging that they had to like pee in bushes or that they didn't even want to get called to go on set because it would just lengthen their day. And then the episodes came out on Sundays and everyone was just like, I can't believe Maddie would ever do that to Cassie or something, you know.
And oh, like, other way around.
Yeah.
God, those responses were also very weird to me because Maddie, I guess, I've watched some episodes of the show. I think I watched like half of the first season and then read the recaps. I watched part of one of the middle.
Season.
Yeah. I watched the first episode of the second season, and then I was reading the recaps after that. But I think Barbie Ferreira, who plays Kat, even got injured on set in where she was just, like Sadie said, making background reaction faces in some big scene for a big showy Golden Globes nom scene for Cassie, for a thin white woman character. Not awesome. I'm kind of interested to see how that's all going to play out, given this press. And because I've seen more of the thin white people who have been more of the, gotten some more of the meatier stuff on the show, have been speaking out about how they felt pressured to do unnecessary nude scenes and everything. So both the Cassie chick, Sydney Sweeney, and Jacob Elordi popped up saying like he was uncomfortable with some of the unnecessarily sexified stuff he was asked to do. So I don't know. I'm really interested to see what's going to happen with the season three of all that apparently is due in 2024.
I just kind of feel like as media has gotten more diverse around certain aspects of race, sexual orientation, and gender identity, like it feels almost like the body fascism has gotten worse. And like, yeah. Sometimes I go back and watch something in the 2000s and I'm like, no, it's way better now. But then something like Euphoria or just like any teen marketed show these days, and it's like, oh, I kind of feel like they're trying to make it more diverse, but they're like weirdly compensating for it by having everyone be like even more impossibly thin than like we expected people to be in the 2000s.
And I,
is that just my like, misperception, or is that happening?
No, I don't think it is. I think that it's an active effort to try to make Instagram filters and Facetune become reality. You know, it's sort of like casting people who are so who that they can be like, look, they really just look like this. And so even though you can Facetune yourself to look like this, you're still not good enough, is what the teens of today are getting. So learning about Photoshop did not liberate us.
I remember seeing a TikTok. This was a while ago, and I cannot even remember what character they were talking about, but it was like a TikTok, probably Euphoria stan teen, who was complaining because one of the characters of color in a show was fat. And they were like, they're basically saying like, it's bad representation. Like, why would you, like, of course, one of the characters of color is fat, like you're sidelining them. And it's like, I don't know how to tell you that fat people are also people. And furthermore, fat people can be of any race and any gender identity and any sexuality. Like, I don't know how to tell you that fat people of color also would like characters to look like them on screen. I simply don't know how to tell you that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you could tell them that because they're operating from the premise that anyone who is not near impossibly thin to a standard that anyone, even somebody who is thin, would have to work for is just not acceptable and should not exist if they're coming from that stance in the first place.
Bridget Jones is bad representation, but it's all we have.
God, I don't know.
She's a babe. Renee Zellweger is a super babe in Bridget Jones. And it's interesting also to, like, I haven't really delved deeply into the research on this, but as Samantha mentioned earlier, that the execrable third entry in the series, which we will all go in on here shortly, coming back in 2016, was after Renee Zellweger had taken an extended break from appearing on screen. And I did read a little bit about, because I was like, what happened to Renee Zellweger then? She was kind of really popping off there for a while and then disappeared. And it took me back a little bit, and I did find some headlines, and media, particularly, I mean, British media is known for being the most toxic possible. And they really, I think we can give them that crown even over. But American celebrity media also has historically been incredibly horrible. And just reading some of the quotes about, like, from, like, legitimate publications, like, that people were proud to put their bylines on, the things that people said about Renee Zellweger's face and body when she was making these movies is just fucking appalling. Like, I don't know, like, if I were her and I had enough money to not work again, I would simply stay away and become a hermit. Yeah. I mean, Jesus Christ, like...
Instead, she came back and got nominated for an Academy Award for playing Judy Garland or something, right?
So, she did.
Well, she did.
Welcome back.
Welcome back, Renee. And you know what? I love, my favorite Renee Zellweger thing is her Roxy Hart in the film version from, like, also the early 2000s with Catherine Zeta-Jones as Velma and stuff. She was amazing in that.
I do not like Richard Gere in that movie. No, please replace him with anyone.
My God. What if it had been even Hugh Mungo Grant? I mean, anyone.
That would have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah. As his Paddington 2 great. Character. Should we start picking some other guys franchise-wide?
Yes, we should. Hugh Mungo as a starter. Okay, so if he actually were, and I do think that in the second movie, he was, or and again, we'll get into the racism and homophobia again here in a minute after. First, we'll talk about other
I know
guys.
We do, but must we? I
we
feel
must,
like our fat phobia conversation
briefly,
has sucked
must.
Everything out on me.
We've done fat phobia. Okay, cool. Look, these movies have no black people, and
the Thailand segment is extremely problematic on multiple
wild
fronts.
Amount of anti-Asian racism throughout from, and it's kind of in the first movie, it's presented as a joke that you're like, oh, okay, we're supposed to think that the Bridget's mom character is gauche and horrible for saying something just like racist and gross off the cuff about Mark Darcy's Japanese ex-wife, you know? But then it just kind of keeps, they just keep building. They won't stop. There's a segment, is in the second or the third, where they confuse like a leader of a country with his taxi driver and put the driver on screen. And that's just like brushed over. Like that's a whoops, little gaffe for the white people at this thing. My God, somebody else take over the Thailand prison sequence right now, because holy fuck, that was horrifying.
They end up singing a popular song and everyone's just like, we love you, you're our hero now that you're in this prison with us,
now
and not like you are a wealthy white tourist
taught
who
us
is like
how not to mispronounce the words to a Madonna song in our accent.
Yeah.
It was really bad, and it was like, and I see like where Sadie's coming from watching this like as a white kid, you know, and like not real that it is presented as this super uplifting, fun, heartwarming scene where the actors are having a good time and it's a fun dance sequence. But like watching it now, it's like, holy fucking shit.
Oh,
and then they're all
like
just used
record.
As to like,
yes, I agree. It is very problematic.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm not trying to say, Sadie, that you're defending this.
I'm not like,
I get why Sadie was
really
I get why this
sweet
was your
spot
favorite scene
for
in
me.
The whole franchise.
Yeah. No, but if I'm thinking about myself, like if I saw this when I was like 12, I would think that like, oh, that's really fun and great. She thought prison would be scary, but she made friends and this is cool. But watching it through adult eyes and seeing Asian women being used as just this throwaway learning backdrop for Bridget is awful. And they have had that built in since the first movie when they have the whole thing with the human rights court case that Mark Darcy, like proving his love for Bridget, gets her an exclusive interview that she is in no way qualified for and should absolutely fucking not be doing. you know, with somebody who's facing a really traumatic, like, it's just super weird to be, and it's very, it's just super Asian racism is like a-okay throughout these movies is like the vibe. They're like, well, we're not, we're like, it's okay to be really racist about Asian people. It carries through the whole thing. And it's really distressing to watch with 2022 eyes. And I wish
do like in the third movie where there's a misunderstanding about Patrick Dempsey and Mark Darcy being a gay couple and with Bridget being the surrogate. And Mark Darcy is like, no, I would have to try myself for buggery if I were a poster. I don't know. It felt like they were trying to make him really like old fashioned in 2016 by making him like uncomfortable with that presumption.
Ooh, and they did that too.
I'd like to think Mark Darcy's a worldly man who would, I don't know.
Right.
Have a little flexibility
Mark
there.
Mark Darcy is defending like a Pussy Riot type of band, but Asian chicks, and they have to have him to some like scene with him rebonding with Bridget where they're specifically making fun of these women who are activists against a dictatorial regime. And it's like, goddamn, man. Like, why did you have to do that? Like, why did
In
you write
Darcy's
this?
Defense, when everyone is making fun of them, he's trying to interject to be like, it's quite a serious case, really. Which was maybe a bright spot for me in
but
the third movie.
I did! Privately makes fun of them later with Bridget. Ooh.
Let Sadie speak.
I'm sorry. Sorry, Sadie. I need to stop screaming.
Well, I was just going to say, I think part of the reason why the third movie feels so just like disconnected and why like the character of Mark Darcy in particular feels so not what you would expect him to be at the stage is because this movie came like about 8 years too late. You know, like, I think that the basic concept of the movie, I'm so sorry. Can you hear Harriet scratching on her scratch post? I'm so sorry.
I was wondering.
She's going apeshit over there. Anyway, I like the concept of like Bridget has sex with this other person after she's broken up with Mark Darcy. Then she gets back together with Mark Darcy, discovers she's pregnant. Like that's very Bridget Jones of her, you know? But it's the fact that it came in like kind of like it's just kind of late. Like 2016 is way too late to be telling the story. If she had been with Mark for maybe 2 to 3 years, right? And then she breaks up with him and then this plot happens. That just makes a lot of sense. Like she would be in her mid 30s. It would still make sense that she would want to go to a music festival. This is not to say that like people in their 40s can't go to music festivals, but it just doesn't entirely fit. I don't know. The whole concept of it doesn't fit. Like also why is Patrick Dempsey also there? Like it just doesn't totally make sense. Everything would just make
like who
more
was
sense.
Patrick Dempsey originally planning to hook up with in that yurt for two, you know? I mean, they tried to
Ed Sheeran.
I hope Ed Sheeran. I hope Ed Sheeran.
Mark Darcy.
Yeah, Mark Darcy. Is that your ship, Sadie? Is Mark Darcy with Jack Quant?
Now listen here. I know that I pitch a lot of thruples, and I know that this one would be a big pill to swallow. But I think that this thruple would work. I think that this thruple could work.
This would be the worst thruple of all time.
What do you mean?
They would have to have separate compounds, you know, like, which I guess not all thruples live together, but I feel like Jack Quant and Mark Darcy would not be able to stand each other.
Yeah.
I feel
well, and then you would have kind of like the agent of chaos in Bridget. You would have the enabler in Jack Quant because he's just met her and he like is not trying to introduce stability into her life really whatsoever. He's just trying to fire it up.
Like,
and you have Mark Darcy who
Well,
but can
you know
he?
What?
Because he, in spite of being a successful human rights lawyer, he does not use his words and solve adult communication issues ever.
I think for the first time in my life, I was maybe wrong. You're right. in that this is unprecedented.
Wow.
I think that this
I'm glad
the first
it happened
time
on the podcast.
But I, it's the thing where, like, I just feel as though seeing that in 2016, Bridget and Mark broke up, it just kind of, it doesn't entirely ruin the first two movies, but it kind of ruins the first two movies because it's like, we go through all of this twice, two movies worth. And then for what? For them to just break up over something, again, extremely non-important. And go on this journey. And it's like now they're like in their mid 40s and they're still acting this way. Like, it's disappointing. It's not what I wanted for Bridget or for Mark. You
Here's
so
my
right.
fantasy for how I want things to end up shipped and shaped in the fourth movie, which came out in my head. Hugh Grant, who we've learned was alive at the end of three, reveals that, that Mark Darcy had planted a bomb on his plane. Like, Mark Darcy tried to take him out of the running for Bridget's heart permanently by, like, sabotaging his plane. So he has to get his revenge. The comedic misunderstanding is that he kills Mark Darcy. And Bridget Jones is like, what? Why did you do that? Why did you kill my husband? And then the third act, you know, he clarifies, oh, I did it because your husband tried to kill me. And then they fall in love. She's like immediately fine with it after he says that.
I feel like she would be. She doesn't have a lot of, I don't know,
yeah,
object
Bridget
permanence.
Bridget Jones remembers the last 5 minutes of her life and nothing past that.
Yeah, Sadie, that frustrated me too, that when they jumped back in the third, it was like what bothered Samantha about the J-Lo Owen Wilson flick we watched recently, that there's like no acknowledgement of the long history and anything that may have changed or anything. It's just the same situation, you know?
Yeah.
So my other guy situation is that I was incredibly charmed by Rebecca Gillies, the lawyer who, mm-hmm. who was in love with Bridget, whilst Bridget was looking at her through jealous eyes, thinking that she was a love rival for Mark Darcy. And Rebecca is looking at her with the goo-goo eyes of love the entire time. Bridget was not into it. I think that Rebecca Gillies should have gone for Shazzer.
Mm.
Rebecca Gillies clearly wants like somebody who's a little more fly by the seat of their pants, fun, you know, like less in this
Shazzer
world.
Shazzer has had a rough track
which
record.
Which Shaz clearly is. Yes. Shazzer has had a rough track record. By the way, I also want to make a public service announcement to anyone who is below the shockingly ancient age of 32 at this point, who may be listening to this podcast, that you would be very surprised, perhaps having watched a lot of movies like this, to think that someone younger would hit on you when you feel very ancient and in your 30s. But when you are a woman in your 30s, young 20s years old dudes just start leaping out of little holes in the woodwork everywhere trying to hit on you. Like, it's really strange. And if you're not prepared for it,
out of your
it
walls
can take you by surprise because you're
you.
Like, oh, me? Oh, why? I'm the crypt keeper. And that's how you get...
Mickey Mouse? Are you here?
That is how you get to a bad
a very
situation.
Image.
Like when Shaz weirdly accepts this. Also, why the fuck would this guy have her smuggling cocaine when he doesn't even have plans to meet back up with her? Is he just a guy who likes to plant thousands and thousands of dollars worth of cocaine on his hookups just as a lark? Like, just so that they'll get arrested and, like, locked in jail forever in, like, a foreign country?
Yeah, like, what was his goal?
I don't know.
Once it was smuggled in.
Like, I was, and then happened? He was in Dubai. I don't know. But just be aware so that you don't get conned by a Jed situation, that it is incredibly normal and common when you're in your 30s for young people to be like trying to rub up on you, and just be smart about that and don't accept their gifts of snake bowls.
Snake bowl. Snake bowls. Okay.
Snake bowls?
Either way, just you gotta be cautious out there, y'all.
Keep an eye out.
I'm trying to think what else we do. Who else has things to say about the BJCU? My brain is scrambled.
Anyway, see, Shazzer should go back home and get with a responsible person like Rebecca Gillies, and then all would be well.
I
wanted
impart-
the lesbian direction as well. I would have accepted that.
I will just impart some final words before we move on to rating, which is that despite its flaws, I think that Bridget Jones is such comfort food for me. And I think that it's a time capsule of very early 2000s, even late 90s life that feels like, I feel like Bridget Jones filled the Sex and the City hole for me, because it was just like a relatable woman. I'm not going to finish this because I still don't know what Sex and the City is really about, but I feel like it filled that void for me.
It's about two things, Sadie.
I think it's about Big dying on a Peloton.
It's about a group of out-of-touch, wealthy white women from New York going to, quote, the new Middle East and riding camels. And, oh, I wish that movie had never happened. Anyway, sorry, Sadie.
No. That was basically all I was going to say. And I think that also the Darcy cinematic universe, it's perfect. He is the perfect person for me, I feel. He's like catnip. Mark Darcy is catnip to me, and that I rest my case. And I don't personally recognize Bridget Jones' Baby as being part of the canon, but to each his own.
Well, I guess we need to rate all of the movies. So, my object will be blue soup. It was blue soup, right?
Blue soup is first. Wait, do you have to pick a movie specific rating for each movie?
I am, for the sake of my frail brain, going to be blue soup all the way down. I'll give the first one 4 bowls of blue soup out of 5. The second one, 3 bowls of blue soup out of 5. And the last one, 0. An empty bowl of blue soup. Just blue residue clinging to the bowl.
I will,
okay,
proceed. Oh, no. You go ahead, Jen.
Oh, you sure? I just thought of my rating, so I'm ready to jump in, but I can wait for you to go first. I feel like, Sadie, you're going to take us out on a better note, so I will proceed now. I will give the first movie, for the charm of Renee Zellweger and the soundtrack and the fight scene, I will give it 1 pair of enormous panties and 1 pair of flimsy tiger striped panties for a 2 out of 5. The second one, I will give... I'll give it a fall off a ski lift and a pregnancy test and shrooms in the ocean for a 2.5 out of 5. Ooh. And the third, I shall give Ed Sheeran rolling around Glastonbury in a giant hamster ball for a non-rated score. That's just what it is. Ed Sheeran in a large inflatable ball.
Talk about object permanence. Jen's object recall is always amazing the end of these episodes.
Thank you.
I will give the first movie 5 tarts out of 5. And I will give the second movie 5 Vickers out of 5. And I give the third nothing. because I dislike it. And I don't think that it should exist. And that is my official stance.
Simply nothing.
I am probably in the top 1 percentile of Bridget Jones fans. So my word is law. Thank you.
And you should be taxed accordingly.
I should be taxed accordingly.
Jen, what sort of hijinks should people subject us to at their local fire station?
I was waiting to hear how you're going to lead this in, because I have to respond to it on the fly. And like, what? Well, when you get caught awkwardly in the slide down and have to climb back up and then slide down and plant your pantyhose butt on our faces, you... should do that on Twitter at YSSTOG.
Hell yeah.
I mean, Twitter is the only platform where you could do that, given content moderation.
Yeah, if you want to put your butt in our faces, we would welcome that on our Twitter at YSSTOG. If you would prefer a more Mark Darcy-ish, long form, formal approach and would like to write us an email, be warned that we do not check our email very often, but we are always very excited when we do and find that we have received one. You can write us there at YSSTOGpodcast@gmail.com. And most importantly, if you would like to help support our free, no advertisements podcast for all this streaming of movies that we do, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/YSSTOG. One of these other heathens can say the other name for the website you can use to get to that here in a moment if they so wish. And if you do that, that will get you access to our Discord, where we like to discuss, all kinds of things like animal actors and Hugh Mungo Grant and Mark Brandanowitz of Parks and Recreation.
And that's it, really.
And I'm really selling it now. But yeah, come join us on Discord. And we have some tiered rewards where you can also get cool monthly playlists from Sadie and stuff, and even select a movie for us to watch and discuss on this podcast. We love you.
Give me a second to find it. Give me a second. I said give me a second.
You're just psyching yourself up.
Give me a second.
I heard the long inhale and the long exhale. I thought it was just meditative.
Okay. I'm ready. I'd like to thank our lovely, wonderful Patreons, Logan Mayonnaise, Andrew, Althea, Xenolon, Sharon, Justin, Evan, Liz, Brittany, Ace, Mara, Raimi, The Void, Heartleaf, Ave with Teeth, Hadas, Ryan, Maddie, and Abby. Is Harriet scratching on her post again? Yes, she is! Harriet, please! I'm just... well, anyway, we love you all very much,
you're
and so does Harriet.
From our Patreon.
Damn. How do we take this one out? I guess now we're all going to run out into the street in our underwear to seek out our our lovers and make up for our misdeeds.
Cut me off.